I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. Our guest this hour writes that life in the Arab world for gay people is hard to fathom. It is, like many other parts of life in this region, complicated. Salim Haddad is with us this hour. Salim has quite a background. It's very mixed. He's Palestinian, Lebanese, Iraqi, German, Muslim, and Christian. He's lived in many countries around the Middle East. He is also a gay man, describes himself as someone who is both queer and Arab, both English and Arabic. Salim has written for The Daily Beast, The Myth of the Queer Arab Life. He is the author of the novel just published, WAPA, and he advises international organizations on humanitarian and development issues in the Middle East and North Africa. He divides his time between the Middle East and London, where he lives with his partner and their greyhound. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter, all these places. That's at K Dunn Show. He joins us by phone from London, and interestingly enough, the second hour of our program today will be talking about whether or not the United Kingdom should remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union. We'll ask Salim his thoughts about that a little bit later in the show. Salim, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. You have done some really interesting writing. You talk about the dual struggle for gay Arabs, queer Arabs, battling oppressive forces within your own communities and resisting the global narrative that tries to use oppression for broader military or political goals. Let's start with this second part of that. What is the global narrative?
I think there's for especially LGBT Arabs who are of my age, I mean, when we're talking people in their 20s and 30s, we grew up in the shadow of 9/11 and the war on terror and the military invasions in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we've seen the narrative become shaped for these interventions, for these military interventions in the Middle East and North Africa, using gender and using the issue of women's rights, for example, in Afghanistan being a rallying cry to invade the country, less so in Iraq. And I think for LGBT Arabs and LGBT Muslims more broadly, I think there's an increasing use of the narrative to quote-unquote liberate gay Arabs or gay Muslims being used along the same line. So for those of us who are at these intersections of identities, we often have to battle fighting homophobia and misogyny and patriarchy in our own communities, but we also are very wary not to let this fight be co-opted for political or military goals, primarily American goals.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about liberating gay Muslims. Is that needed? And I guess we should define what liberation would mean in Western terms and in Arab terms.
Yes. Well, I think I would maybe take a step back. I think for gay Arabs and for the LGBT community in the Middle East, in terms of articulating the challenges that we face, one thing that has really been important for a lot of us is to articulate our problems as part and our desires for protection, for personal rights, and for body freedoms within the wider context of the need for dignity and justice for all citizens in the Middle East. So we are not just struggling for our queer identity, we're also struggling for our freedoms as citizens in many countries that are either military dictatorships or authoritarian regimes. So when we're talking about liberating queer Muslims, I think, or queer Arabs, it's not just our queer identity that needs to be liberated. We're fighting a number of different fights at the same time.
You have a lot going on, don't you?
It's complicated.
Yes.
It's complicated. It's not complicated.
Yeah, it sounds like it's very complicated. I haven't had a chance to read your novel, although I really, after having read about what you said about it, I'm interested in reading it. You have said in an interview that you almost didn't write your novel, that you thought of your parents and the shame your father would feel as his son exposed himself so openly. You also feared that it would make it more difficult to go back to the Arab world, the place you call home, and that you love about all else. But you did write the novel.
I did write the novel, and the only way that I could write the novel was to enter into trance of some kind, where I was not thinking about the implications of what I was putting down on the page. I had to just tell the truth. That was what I kept telling myself every day as I was writing, not to worry too much about the implications or whether it would ever see the light of day, but to just tell the truth as I knew it. And after I did that, and I was able to really write down. And the book is a very emotional book. It's a very vulnerable book, and I think that's why it has resonated with a lot of people beyond just Arabs or the LGBT community more broadly. And that was because I really wrote it with this idea that I was going to just allow myself to be vulnerable. But of course, that does come with fears. I mean, the fears are very much personal. When I'm talking about issues around sex and about love and about my own fears and desires, both political fears and desires and also personal fears and desires, that does put me in a very vulnerable situation, you know, with my father, but also with my wider community in the Middle East. So I definitely had concerns.
And have you had reaction to the book that's been negative from some of those people you were concerned about or not?
No. I have been quite shocked at how the book has been embraced by many people in the Middle East. I mean, keeping in mind that it so far has only been published in English, so it's only reaching a small segment of the population in the Arab world. But within that, the responses I've received have been overwhelmingly positive. It's been great to connect with other LGBT Arabs in the region and know that the novel speaks to them in a certain way. I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that for Arabs in general, but specifically LGBT Arabs, there aren't very many, if any, positive representations of Arabs or queer Arabs in popular media or culture. And I wrote about this as well. I mean, for someone who lies at the intersections of, you know, Western identity and Arab identity and queer identity, there are no positive representations of us in popular culture in the future. So I think the fact that there is this book, I think it has spoken to some people. And I think beyond LGBT Arabs, I think people want to have this discussion in the Middle East, and they want to see people contribute to this discussion. Mm-hmm. So it's been very positive.
But you talk about, and you spent a whole lot of time in coffee houses and in clubs in the Middle East, so there are those places, and you talk about how important they have been to you, places where you can talk politics, where you can feel secure, mm-hmm. where you can have very honest conversations.
Yes. I mean, bars and coffee shops are very important spaces for young Arabs, not just queer Arabs, but young Arabs in general. When you consider that for most of us, we don't move out of our family's house until we get married, those places, those bars and coffee shops are places for us to really have the space to explore ideas, explore identities, talk politics, away from the family, away from, in some cases, the government. And especially for queer Arabs, I think those spaces are very important. And I don't think it's just limited to the Middle East. I mean, when you look at the aftermath of Orlando, mm-hmm. the importance of these nightclubs and bars for LGBT communities around the world can't be overstated, because they're safe spaces. And they're safe spaces because even in the U.S., the wider culture is not a safe space for LGBT people, Arab or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I would like your response to, you mentioned Orlando, the New York Times, you're in London, so you probably didn't see this, had a very interesting front page story today titled Killings Drive New Urgency to Come Out. And it talks about the number of Puerto Rican young men who were killed in Orlando, a 19-year-old dancing at the Pulse, unbeknown to his Puerto Rican father and Cuban mother. His mother had raised him in a church where parishioners learned that gay people went to hell. Loretta Lynch, our attorney general, saying yesterday, let me quote her, "Let me say to our LGBT friends and family, particularly to anyone who might view this tragedy as an indication that their identities, their essential selves, might somehow be better left unexpressed or in the shadows. This Department of Justice and your country stands with you in the light." Does that resonate with you in any way?
It does, in a way. It's funny because there's a lot of debate about the value of coming out among LGBT Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, and my opinion is by no means representative of the wider community, I think coming out is a very important step in living authentically. At least that's how I found it for myself. I felt I could not live authentically unless I came out. But for many other LGBT Muslims and Arabs, coming out is not something that they feel is important to them, either because they view their sexuality as a private matter or because they don't have the ability to come out. So there are stages of coming out. But for me, the Orlando tragedy was a very difficult thing to process. I was in London when it happened, and actually we were at a gay club that night on Saturday night, and the next morning we woke up to the news, and I was immediately very angry and very sad. And also there was a part of me that, and this is an impulsive thought that I think many Middle Easterners feel, is I really hope it's not a Muslim.
Mm.
And when in the initial narrative of the events, when it was discovered that Omar Mateen was a Muslim and he was of Afghan origin, the narrative that quickly took shape felt unstoppable, that for the Muslim and Arab LGBT community, we felt we had no time to grieve because we had one of our safe spaces destroyed, and we were in the process of seeing all our other safe spaces being attacked. And so I think there's this immediate reaction to try and understand what does Islam say about homosexuality, and what does the Muslim community say about homosexuality, and the way that the political narrative developed both by Donald Trump and by Hillary Clinton immediately started attacking Islam and the Muslim community. And so when that first started, and now as we get more information, we find out that naturally, because there is no such thing as us versus them, the world is a lot more complicated than these binary oppositions. Once we've realized that Omar Mateen was not a member of ISIS or did not do this in the name of ISIS, at least in any organized form, and he very likely was closeted himself, the mainstream media seems to have shifted away from it. So it becomes less a question of this is a Muslim who has attacked us, and the us being a white-washed, straight identity, because the victims who are predominantly queer and Latino were suddenly not spoken about in terms of their sexuality and their race. But now that it became a question of, you can say, gay on gay violence, the mainstream media seems to have lost interest somewhat in this. And it does bother me because I feel like there are wider questions around masculinity that need to be explored. And this masculinity and homophobia is prevalent in all communities, in all contexts, whether Muslim or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a story with all kinds of levels, isn't it? And again, people take on, as you write about, how people take on certain issues, military issues, wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, based on what a political viewpoint it is, and then uses a community for their own advantage, really.
Exactly. And that's a big challenge for a lot of the Muslim LGBT community in speaking publicly, is the fear, not the fear of coming out, but the fear of being instrumentalized.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about how the community has been instrumentalized. We've touched on it, but give me some detail.
There is, I think there's on the one hand, one of the most common questions that I get asked is to try and explain, in many ways, to try and explain how homophobia operates in Islam. Which is fine. Homophobia is, like I said, you know, pervasive in Muslim majority communities. And I mean, I use the term Muslim majority, but we're talking about a very broad, we're talking about 1.6 billion people. But to talk about homophobia in Muslim majority communities, and that's okay, but the problem then becomes when that discourse is used by politicians like Donald Trump to justify banning Muslims from entering the U.S. On the basis that they are homophobic. It's to bring it to an example in Europe, where the question of refugees coming in from Syria and elsewhere is a very hot topic. One thing that is consistently being done is to highlight how these Muslim majority refugees are sexually attacking European women, how they are homophobic and they need to be. And there actually are these courses that are done for refugees here when they come into Europe on addressing homophobia in refugee communities, addressing homophobic attitudes by refugees towards the wider community. And so, and this discourse is also used to justify closing the borders to these refugees because they are not like us. The assumption that homophobia is something that exists only in Muslim communities, homophobia is something that exists only in Arab communities, and we in the West don't suffer from this problem, or at least not to the degree that it exists over there. Whereas what I try and do in my writing and in my work more broadly is to show that in many ways it's all interconnected. When you look at homophobic attacks that are done by the Egyptian state against gay men in Egypt, these are attacks done by a police force that receives, you know, $1.6 billion of military aid a year from the U.S. government. This money specifically goes to controlling the Egyptian population. It goes to entrenching patriarchal and masculinist systems that then go on to perpetuate violence against LGBT communities. So understanding these connections and understanding the way that homophobia operates through these political and military relationships between the West and the Middle East is very important for me.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Salim. Salim Haddad is our guest. He is a writer. He's an aid worker. We'll also want to talk to him about all of the issues that he's been working on, the refugee crisis being among them. He feels as though people have just really been left to die, that the world doesn't care about that issue. I am interested in his work in the area. He's done a lot of writing. His first novel was just published in spring of this year. He's written and came to our attention from his writing in the Daily Beast, The Myth of the Queer Arab Life. And we're talking to you as well. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Salim Haddad is our guest now, and he is a writer. He's also worked with a number of NGOs on important issues on refugees and other issues. Let's talk more about class here, class, gender, and the complex interplay. You write that people who don't want to be seen as gay, sexual identities in the Middle East intersect with class, gender, and a complex interplay, private and public, which makes it impossible to speak of a single gay Arab experience. But what's the class and gender aspect of all of this, Salim?
From a class perspective, I think the amount of protection that you have to live to practice relations depends on how much money you have. If you can afford to buy yourself into the safe spaces that exist in the cities, in Arab cities. So, for example, I mean, in places like Beirut, there are a multitude of gay and nightclubs that exist and where gay men and to a lesser degree, gay women meet and can have a great time. However, in order to enter into those spaces, you need to be able to afford to pay your way inside. So paying the amount for drinks, etc., offers you an element of protection. When you look at the crackdowns that are happening in places like Egypt and in Lebanon against gay people, those tend to be in spaces that are predominantly lower class areas, where men of lower class congregate. So they're often in bathhouses, in some cinemas, where gay men meet to engage in same-sex practices. So for me, in writing that article, I felt it was important to bring a class dimension to this, to say that the fact that I can afford to buy myself into a safe space in a nightclub or a bar in Beirut makes my experience of being a gay Arab very different than someone who has no choice but to go to a bathhouse or a cinema where he or she is at greater risk of being attacked.
Mm-hmm. And you tell the story, please tell us, of the cinema where there was a crackdown and the TV host who was part of the fun at the cinema.
Yeah, so there, I think this was in 2012 in Beirut. The Lebanese police cracked down on a number of what they call gay cinemas, which are cinemas. Well, they don't call them gay. They're more sex cinemas where they show pornography on the screens, and men often have sex in these cinemas. Some of these cinemas were exposed in a Lebanese television show called, ironically, You Are Free. That was the name of the television show. And they sent undercover journalists into these spaces, and they filmed what was taking place in those cinemas. In response, the Lebanese police raided some of these cinemas in the lower-class neighborhoods in Beirut, but also in Tripoli, which is in northern Lebanon. In response to this raid and to the television show that exposed these cinemas, a number of gay activists in Beirut released some photographs of the host of the television program who, in a gay nightclub in Mykonos, Greece. So they basically outed the television host. And in response, he came out saying, of course, decrying the speaking out against his privacy being exposed. And he also said that by exposing those cinemas, he was not making a comment against same-sex practices. He was making a comment against public morality. And my point in highlighting that story is to shed light on how class dimensions play into protection. So that if you have the money, you can buy yourself a gay identity in Mykonos. You can travel to Mykonos and have a great time in the gay bars and the gay nightlife there. If you don't, then you simply head to a rundown cinema and cross your fingers.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this. One of your articles talks about when you were very young and you were watching this Egyptian performer, Sharahan, I believe, a woman who did this singing and dancing extravaganza, who you say planted in you the first seeds of your own gay identity.
Well, the funny thing so when I was younger, there was a performer called Sharahan. She was a belly dancer, a singer, an actress. And she was very much the Lady Gaga of her time. I mean, if you look back at some of her costumes and performances, they remind you of how Lady Gaga was when she first came out. And I remember being young and watching them, and they used to air during Ramadan, and just thinking, this woman is fabulous. And it's funny because growing up as someone who didn't see very obvious Arab gay role models, it wasn't until I really looked back at my childhood and looked back at the Arab culture that I was exposed to growing up that I began to see how queer identities came out in very different elements of Arabic music and television culture. And Shirihan was one of those elements. She was someone who was very much a drag queen of her time. She was very queer, very flamboyant, and it's funny because I wrote that article, and then ever since I've had so many gay Arabs come up to me and say, "Yes, yes, you
really?
Too, you too, Shirihan." So I realized it wasn't just me. Actually, she really spoke to a much wider audience than that, which is fantastic.
We had an email from someone wanting for you to define what queer means within the LGBT world, how it fits in.
Well, for me, I prefer queer because I think the challenge that I have with the notion of a gay identity or a lesbian identity is that they tend to be quite fixed and very binary identity. So you have homosexual and you have heterosexual. To me, why I prefer to use the word queer, I find it a more inclusive term. I find it a more empowering term. And when I say queer, I'm trying to bring the politics of LGBT life, inject politics back into LGBT life to say that actually queer is not just being gay. It's also fundamentally questioning heterosexual society and heterosexual norms that we exist in.
And it doesn't bother you that it was used in such a derogatory fashion for so many years?
No, I mean, no. And I feel like I have reclaimed that word. To me, that word symbolizes power. It symbolizes pride in difference. And that's something that I explore in the book as well. We have very derogatory terms for that are similar to queer. We have one called shad, which means deviant. In Arabic, and I explore that in the book. And although that word hasn't been reclaimed, it's still considered a lot of activists say that it's too soon to reclaim the word shad. But to me, I feel like it can be quite empowering to really celebrate deviance, because when you're deviating from something that is oppressive or that is if you're deviating from structures and practices that are promoting violence, then a deviant could be a positive person.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we go to Abraham in Green Bay. Hi, Abraham.
Hello, Kathleen. I have a question for your guest, and these two questions, but I'll try to put them in one. I am a Muslim Somali student at UWGB, and I often get in, comedically enough, Saudi matches with some community members, you know, about the whole concept of gay rights. Now, I know that back at the peak of the Islamic Empire, that homosexuality was apparently well accepted, and there were actually homosexual celebrities in that world. And they were actually homoerotic writing. Now, I have been faced by this one argument, and I don't know where its basis is coming from. And the Quran does not say anything about homosexuality, as far as I know. But there is this constant argument that it is un-Islamic. If you're homosexual, then therefore you're not a Muslim anymore. Anytime I make the argument for gay rights, I want to ask your guest how he reconciles that, and how he defines a Muslim gay, because apparently, and I've asked a few people around in the mosque around here, and you know they all agree on that. How does he reconcile that, and how does he define what it means to be gay and Muslim at the same time? And do the two even go together?
Thank you, Ibrahim. Salim.
So I should probably start by saying that I don't identify Muslim, as a gay Muslim. My mother is Muslim, and my father is Christian, Christian Catholic, Palestinian Christian Catholic. And so I grew up primarily Catholic. And my experience with Catholicism is that, like Islam, Christianity does not have many good things to say about homosexuality, and neither does Judaism. So I think if there's one thing that we can say is that, at the end of the day, all three of those religions do not say kind things about homosexuals. And there's been a lot of work done by gay Muslims and those who identify as gay Muslims looking at the Quran, looking at the Sunnah and what the Prophet has said, to try and identify and analyze different passages and what they mean. I won't go into that because it's not my specialty, but I would agree with the caller. I mean, it's funny because in the Middle East, when you look at the countries where there are specific laws that prohibit or criminalize homosexual practice, so many of those laws were actually taken from the British and the French constitutions when they had colonized those countries. So Egypt and Lebanon, which have some of the anti-gay laws, those were actually taken from Europe. So it's very complicated, and there's no clear-cut answer. And I also find it funny when ISIS talk about bringing back the caliphate and going back to the Islamic Golden Age, because the Islamic Golden Age was all about wine and male poets talking about the beauty of the male body and falling in love with other men. So I'm curious to see how ISIS would reconcile those two differences.
Hmm. Do you consider yourself religious at all or not?
I grew up religious. I grew up religious. My grandmother would take me to church every day.
Every day? That's
sorry,
a lot.
Not every day. No, every Sunday.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we'd have to pray every day, but like we would go to church every Sunday. I would say a prayer every night. So I did grow up religious, but at a certain point, especially when I was coming to terms with my sexuality, I found myself that I could not reconcile Christianity and Catholicism with my sexuality. And it was a very personal decision for me. Once my sexuality began to shed light and poke holes into my faith, it all quickly crumbled away.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about this breakup with your boyfriend. You talk about you were living in Amman, your boyfriend broke up with you, and the reason was, you say, it was being seen with you was making people think he was gay, and he did not want to be seen as gay. Why? Because it was dangerous? Because why wouldn't he? And your life may have been very different if he had not broken up with you.
Yes, I mean, yeah, my life would have been very different if he hadn't broken up with me. I think when I think back to that time, I was in the process of coming out more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
And that also involved questioning a lot of the social codes that I was exposed to and that I was that I had to use with the community that I was a part of. And I think for someone, and he was not at that stage yet, he was from an upper-class family. He had constructed for himself a very masculine Arab public identity. And he could not, and as I increasingly began to question these codes, I think for him it was very difficult because he realized that he either would have to break from me or embrace some of my questioning. And it was a difficult process for him as well. I mean, we both went through a very difficult but very important process. And it's funny because he now lives in the U.S. and he's out and very happy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so there's a happy story at the end of this. But it was a very difficult process when you love someone, and this is something that he told me is, you know, I love you, but we just can't be together because we want different things.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not want to have that gay identity where I was ready to embrace it.
Constantino sends this message on Facebook. I just wanted to say that although my heart aches for all minorities in the Arab world who are abused, including Christians, LGBT, and others, I believe there is historical evidence that it's the interference from the West that keeps the area economically, politically, and culturally unstable and oppressive. So we have to find a way to intervene or help. Does make worse the repressive response of Arab cultures and nations in their interactions with the West? Please comment.
I would agree with him. I mean, I'm always hesitant to find an easy answer to all of these questions. It's very easy to say that the Arab world or the Muslim world is backwards and barbaric and repressed and they need to be liberated. And it's also just as easy to say all the social ills and problems in the Middle East have to do with Western intervention and military intervention. I think the answer lies somewhere in the middle. I think when you look at U.S. military support for regimes who have committed horrible human rights abuses towards their own citizens, but as well to other states as well. And when you look at Egypt, when you look at Saudi Arabia, when you look at Israel, these countries have produced massive human rights violations. And one thing they have in common is they've all received an incredible amount of military support from the U.S. And this support is primarily done to police individuals and societies. So I think there's definitely an element of truth to what the commenter on Facebook said.
Abraham, thank you for your call. We go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
My question was sort of like the same, similar to the last one, but I wonder if your guest feels that his issue is as a gay person and a gay issue, gay rights and so on in the Semitic community, which I was wondering too, that supposed bomber out in Florida, they said he spoke in Arabic and he was a son of an Afghani man, so I don't know how the heck he would learn how to speak Arabic, but anyhow, that's a sideshow, but the takeover of Palestine by Israel and in the past since 1920 and the aggression since then of the West and the new world order of the way you destroyed communism and now we need a new 100-year war and it is going to be against the Muslims and therefore we do 9/11 and therefore we attack and you know from one country to the next eternal turmoil for 100 years. Then you've got the counter turmoil of the invasion of Europe by all the refugees created by this invasion. I'd just like any comment that he might have made on what I perceive there.
All right, John. Salim.
On the Orlando attack, it's funny because the Omar Mateen, the shooter, he at various points in time he pledged allegiance to Hezbollah and then he pledged allegiance to Al Qaeda and then he pledged allegiance to ISIS, and all of these groups are at war with each other. So it shows fundamentally that in terms of his understanding of the politics of the Middle East, there's nothing there. He does not understand the politics in the Middle East if he's pledging allegiance to groups that are in a death battle with each other. And again, for me, I think that what I would like to really shed light on when it comes to the Orlando attacks is this is a homophobic attack. This is an attack that has been carried out in the context of much larger culture and cult of violent masculinity. And when you look at Omar Mateen himself, the shooter, he idolized the NYPD. which has committed violence against people on a regular basis, and especially black people in the U.S. He also was obsessed with guns, and he also worked for G4S, which is a security firm that runs Israeli prisons, and Israeli prisons are notorious for being centers where there's been abuse of juveniles and other instances like that. So he comes from this violent masculinist culture. And I stress this because I think it's the only way for us to really get to the bottom of these attacks and get to the bottom of the violence that's inflicted not just on LGBT populations, in whether it's in the Middle East or in the U.S., but women more broadly as well, and other sexual minorities. But I think it's really important that we try and look at it from that angle. To me, one of the most heartening and one of the most devastating things that I experienced after the Orlando attacks was getting emails and Facebook messages from straight friends and colleagues in Yemen, a country that has been bombed for a year and a half now, continuously expressing their sorrow and grief at the events in Orlando. This, to me, is the beauty of solidarity. You know, when you've been bombed nonstop for a year and a half, and you still take time out of your day in the hour or 2 hours that you have electricity to send a message to your gay friend in London saying, I'm sorry about the attacks in Orlando, that to me is what complicates the picture. Mm-hmm. And I like to complicate things.
Yeah, well, that's good. You should. You're using your mind, Salim, which is a good thing. Salim Haddad is our guest. He is a writer. His first novel, Guapa, was just published a couple months ago. He came to our attention from articles in the Daily Beast, The Myth of the Queer Arab Life. He's a very interesting background. He has an Iraqi German mother, a Palestinian Lebanese father, father Catholic, mother Muslim. He has lived in many countries in the Middle East and is currently living in London with his partner. And, of course, we have to include their greyhound. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. If you would like to join us, the number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and we're on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah in Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, sir, what is it like for lesbians in the Arab world? I only hear on the news about what it's like for the gay man, and I was wondering if the lesbians are hassled as much as gay men?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think this is where gender comes into play, and something that I didn't get a chance to talk about earlier, which is, I think, for women, I think there's a double-edged sword. There's a big element of the homophobia that exists, you know, in the Middle East, but elsewhere, is that it is it almost exposes sort of the veneer of masculinity and challenges masculinity. So especially when you're looking at relationships between two men in the Middle East, it's frowned upon because it's seen as an attack against masculinity, that you would not be with a woman, that you would choose to be a man. So in that sense, I think for gay women, there's less of a shame element to it, because there is no direct challenge to masculinity with two women being together. And on the one hand, it can be it's hidden more, because women's sexuality is more hidden. On the other hand, women's sexuality is policed a lot more than men's sexuality. So I think women face, straight or gay, women face a lot of violence in the Middle East, as they do everywhere else around the world. Their sexuality is policed. Their sexuality is given a certain element of honor that's bestowed on them. And so I think the challenges are quite different. The reason that we don't hear these voices, I think, is because sex is still a very taboo subject in the Middle East, and especially when it comes to women's sexuality, because women's sexuality is very closely linked to the honor of the family. And so a woman speaking openly about sex, let alone gay sex, would be frowned upon in a way that perhaps men can talk about a bit more. There's a great book on female on lesbian life in Lebanon specifically that's worth checking out. It's called Bareed Mustajil, B-A-R-E-E-D, and then M-U-S-T-A-J-I-L. So if you'd like to know more about the daily lives of gay women in Lebanon, I think that's a very good place to start. And you can find a link to that and other resources about homosexuality in the Middle East on my website.
Oh, what's that? And what is your website, Salim?
It's salimhaddad.com.
S-A-L-E-E-M-H-A-D-D-A-D.com. Excellent. I also wanted to spend just a couple moments here talking about there are so many issues that you're involved with. You need several people to do what you're doing. But you've also done a lot of work with NGOs and humanitarian work, aid work. You said something quite provocative in your piece in the Daily Beast that the world really doesn't care about the Arab and Muslim bodies who are washing up on the shores of the Mediterranean. And it keeps happening, doesn't it?
Exactly. And there's a new deal now between the EU and Turkey that is sending those bodies back to the Middle East, alive or dead, back to Turkey. And it's something that's absolutely heartbreaking. I live in Europe and I've been here for 10 years now. My mother's half European. There's a long history of xenophobia in Europe, far right xenophobia, far right fascism. And it is absolutely terrifying to see the way that refugees and immigrants have been talked about in European media and in European public discourse in a way that I don't think, Donald Trump aside, I don't think exists in the U.S. I think that in the U.S. there's still, it is a country of immigrants. There's a history, there's a narrative around the United States of a land of opportunity and a land where people can come and find a new life. Whereas in Europe, I think there's just such a dangerous rhetoric that's taken hold. And it's absolutely terrifying to live in.
And is it part of the reason for the Brexit vote tomorrow?
The Brexit vote to me is an interesting one. If you asked me a year ago about the Brexit vote, I might have said that there are very strong reasons to leave, and that is linked to probably, I would say, more left-leaning arguments for leave around ownership, around restricting to a certain degree the free movement of capital and protecting industries in the UK. I think there's a strong left-wing argument to leave. However, over the last 6 months, the leave campaign has turned to xenophobic and racist campaign tactics that it has completely co-opted and co-opted the argument to leave. And so I have no choice but to support the Remain campaign because I don't want to be associated with xenophobia and racism and a climate of fear and mistrust of the other.
Mm-hmm. You're living in London now for 10 years, you said. Will you go back and live somewhere in the Arab world again? Can you freely travel there now?
Yeah, I can. And I say I live in London. I've been living in London for the last 10 years, but I spend 3 to 4 months a year in the Middle East. My family still live in the Middle East. My friends live in Lebanon and Jordan and Dubai. So I go to these countries a lot, and I feel like I have a life in those countries just as I do in London. Moving back is something that I definitely want to do. It's about finding the right time and place. And it's the Middle East right now is going through a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm. Salim, thank you very much for being with us this hour. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. It's been a pleasure.
Salim Haddad, and you can find his website again, SalimHaddad.com, a writer and an aid worker who writes for the Daily Beast and also has his first novel just published, Guapa, which is written in English. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this interesting hour and to Katie Cyrus for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for listening and for your calls. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll talk about the European Union and whether or not the United Kingdom should remain a member of that union or not. Hour two.